Full committee on the House Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order. It's July 21st, 2005. The purpose of this hearing is to continue the oversight of the VA health budget process for fiscal years 05 and 06. By mutual agreement with the ranking member, Mr. Evans, prior to the hearing, Mr. Evans and I will make brief opening remarks, and members will be recognized for their statements and questions under the five-minute rule. We're here this morning to bring accountability to this process. This is the very reason that I elected to serve in this capacity as chairman of this committee, to bring accountability and credibility to this process. We owe our veterans a dignified, predictable, responsive process that provides quality care and benefits today and into the future. Accountability and credibility will ensure that we have that process, one that veterans and taxpayers can trust. On June 30th, as we met here to determine what resources the administration needed to care for America's veterans, I said, quote, as chairman, getting the VA budget right is about one of the most important things I can do. Without a good budget, how can we provide good care for our nation's veterans? So we're going to get the budget right. And that is what we're going to do. I'm deeply disappointed at the recent series of events that led up to this hearing today. A few weeks ago, before this committee, at a hearing regarding the budget modeling, we were informed about the VA's shortfall. We subsequently asked the Secretary to let us know what he needed. He promptly returned with a number provided to him, for which you provided, Dr. Perlin, from your staff, of $975 million. Before the day was out, the House of Representatives voted the VA the money that was requested to the penny, requested to us on a written transmittal from the President of the United States. As it turns out, that number now appears to be incorrect. Later, we were told, in fact, that the true number for FY05 may, in fact, require an additional $300 million, more than what was originally stated. So I'm interested in your testimony today about the circulation of that number and what it means. Later, the administration delivered a $1.977 billion budget amendment for FY2006 to correct shortfalls in the VA's budget for next year. In order for Congress to exercise its constitutional role to care for veterans, we need to rely on you to provide us timely and accurate information. As I had told you, the senior management of the Department of Veterans Health Administration is responsible for providing us that information. To date, I have not been pleased with some of the responses. I am disappointed by more than just numbers. We've discovered the VA's inability to forecast demand. We've been briefed on the in excess of $325 million in the accounts receivables yet to be collected. The appointment backlogs continue to grow. Although I will pause and say it's the doctors, the nurses, the hospital personnel of VHA who are the true heroes, to also include our volunteers. They care for our wounded and sick veterans every day in our hospitals and our clinics in the VA system. I cannot help but feel as though they are also are not being well served. I intend to push the bureaucracy at the VA to help change it and make it more responsive to the needs of our nation's veterans. This committee will ensure that veterans will receive their care. This committee will hold you, Dr. Perlin, and members of your staff accountable for this system. This committee will take action to ensure the system works and that it serves our nation's veterans and their families. From our oldest survivors of World War I to the most recently returned soldier, sailor, airman, marine, Coast Guardman returning from Iraq, Afghanistan, the War on Terror, and other places around the world and domestically, to also include our new veterans. And that's what we're going to talk about this afternoon. At this point, I'll yield to Mr. Evans for his opening remarks.
Mr. Chairman, the last time we talked here, I expressed my anger over the inability of this administration to live with us and to level with us and level with American veterans as well. Today, I'm still angry, but frankly, I'm also puzzled. The administration's revised request for fiscal year 2006 still fails to fully address the needs of the VA in the upcoming fiscal year. At this late date, the administration still submits a request that relies under policy proposals and that have been overwhelmingly rejected by this Congress and others. Why is this administration still leveling with us? The philosophy put forth is one to drive veterans out of the system, to kick needy veterans out of the long-term health care because they don't have enough beds to serve the veterans, and to gloss over the real mental health problems needed by our veterans. We ask all of our men and women who serve with us to be willing to sacrifice all that they can give. Total honestly tells us that the resources we need is to care for them, and this is the least that you can possibly do. It's an important hearing at this time, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you setting this time this afternoon to hear these issues, and thank you. Thank you, balance.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We'll hear testimony from Dr. Perlin, the Undersecretary for Health, Department of Veterans Affairs. Your written testimony will be submitted in the record, and you are now recognized for 5 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Evans, members of the committee, thank you for your continuing support and ongoing dialogue regarding the interaction of budget forecasting and the finances of the Veterans Health Administration. Coming to me today are Ms. Laura Miller, our Deputy Undersecretary for Operations and Management, and Mr. Jimmy Norris, our Chief Financial Officer in VHA. Mr. Chairman, considering our budget planning and the request for FY05 supplemental appropriation, as well as continuing resource needs for health services for 2006, I'd like to discuss what facts underlie the need for an FY2005 supplemental request. VA requested a supplemental appropriation in the amount of $975 million for FY2005 in June of this year. That supplemental request was needed because our expected forecasted growth based on the actuarial model was 2.3%, and VA discovered in March of 2005 that the actual growth had accelerated through mid-year of 2005 to 5.2%. There was a difference of 2.9% above the original projection. This higher than anticipated demand for VHA services was a major factor driving our need for a supplemental appropriation. Mr. Chairman, as we discussed during our June 23rd hearing, VA uses an actuarial model to forecast patient demand and associated resource needs. Actuarial modeling is a rational way to project the resource needs of a healthcare system like VHA. As I noted at that hearing, that's the approach used by the private sector. Unlike the private sector, however, where the projections are used to formulate budgets for the next year or even the next open season, the federal budget cycle requires budget formulation using data 2.5 to 3.5 years ahead of actual budget execution. For example, the data used to formulate the budget in FY05 derived from healthcare utilization data in FY2002. In this case, the last full year of data before the department's FY2005 budget formulation process began. Our actuarial model forecasted 2.3% annual growth in healthcare demand in FY2005. We discovered that growth had accelerated through mid-year 2005 to 5.2% above 2004. This constitutes a substantial increase in workload and resource requirements. As a result, our increased medical care costs in 05 are $975 million based on increased patient demand and increased utilization of healthcare services. With respect to 2006, I believe that an additional $1.977 billion above the President's budget request is needed to continue to provide timely, high-quality care to enrolled veterans. This includes, for 2006, $300 million to replenish carryover funds that are being used in FY05 to cover the increased average cost per patient. It also includes $677 million to cover an estimated 2% increase in the number of patients expected to seek care in 2006, $400 million to recognize the expected cost of providing more intensive treatment, and $600 million to correct for the estimated cost of long-term care. The administration has come forward to Congress with a proposal to provide VA with these additional resources. The total need for both years is $2.952 billion. Comprising FY2005 supplemental request of $975 million and a FY2006 budget amendment of $1.977 billion. These amounts assume enactment of the policies in the President's budget. If Congress does not accept any of the policies in the President's budget, additional resources to offset the cost of policies not enacted will be needed still. While 2.9% variance above the number of patients projected is far better than the variances that occurred under the previous system when VA budgets were projected simply by inflating a historical base, it's clear that we need to improve the models and methodology's performance, and we'll work with you to improve not only the model and methodology, but the overall process. Indeed, we must. Planned improvements to the model include obtaining access to data on VA enrollees' use of Medicaid, TRICARE, and military treatment facilities, integrating VA's long-term care model into the actuarial model, and modeling additional services, such as dental care. In addition, we need to continue the progress already made with DOD to better engage them in data sharing and projections regarding OIF and OEF returnees. To address the average 3-year time lag in the budget process, we need to also better consider trends in the economy and environment that might not yet be incorporated into past data and then into the model. But we can incorporate those, and they can be provided to adjust our budget formulation process. Clearly, since VA is a low or no-cost provider, we must better anticipate the effects on our system as the other health care options to veterans become more costly. Perhaps more importantly, the Secretary has committed to quarterly reviews with you, with this committee, to address resource needs in light of VHA's most current operational experience. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in closing, I believe the resources requested in the supplemental appropriation for FY 2005 proposed by the administration and the President's budget amendment for FY 2006 reflect the commitment and support by the administration to the veterans of this nation in meeting the increased demand for VHA health care services. Thank you for your support of veterans and VA, and for the opportunity to testify before you on this complex issue.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Perlin. Dr. Perlin, have you briefed the Secretary of Veterans Affairs on VHA's monthly performance reviews for the past 15 months as acting Undersecretary for Health and now as the confirmed Undersecretary for VHA?
Mr. Chairman, the monthly performance review is held with the Deputy Undersecretary presiding, and the Deputy Secretary in turn discusses outcomes of the monthly performance review with the Secretary.
At each of these briefings, how is then the Deputy Secretary briefed on the forecast budget requirements and actual budget execution?
Mr. Chairman, the monthly performance review has virtually for number of veterans using the system, both number of patients as well as the number of enrollees, a column that shows the actual performance, the actual numbers. There's a lag time of 1 to 2 months, depending on how quickly we have the monthly performance review. And that is tracked against both the previous year as well as against plan.
What is the role of the VA's corporate chief financial officer and the chief network officer in formulating and preparing the monthly review?
The VHA's chief financial officer has the role of actually consolidating the data used to put the book together from VHA to provide to the deputy secretary. The execution of the resources, is the line direction for that is provided by the Deputy Undersecretary for Operations and Management, formerly entitled the Chief Network Officer.
When did you inform the Deputy Secretary of a divergence between the 05 budget and the monthly performances?
This is really the key point. As we testified, it was with a lag of about 30 to 60 days, April and May, it was apparent that not only were the numbers of actual veterans tracking above projection, but that this was going to begin to have some impact on budget and not tracking with budget. So I would believe that that would be the April-May monthly performance review where that began to diverge, some early indicators at that point.
Have you been able to decipher why there was such a spike in May?
Historically, there is sort of a seasonal trend in the number of veterans that come to us, but this was an unusually high number that came at this point in the year. What was apparent during the month of May was that we're beginning to diverge not only in terms of the numbers of veterans seeking care, but in terms of the consumption of resources, such as use of capital dollars, non-recurring maintenance, non-critical equipment for the actual operations, paying for the cost of care for those patients.
So when you sent this letter to Congress talking about you're going to have to move $600 million. That was in April? you inform the Appropriations Committee?
Yes, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that there was a letter from the Secretary informing the Appropriations Committee Chairman and Ranking Member to reprogram $600 million of capital and I believe some other administrative dollars for reprogramming as well.
So what we have is this moving target. You inform Congress of about a $600 million to reprogram. In the latter part of June, the testimony is that the shortfall is $975. Then we come back after a July break and we say, oops, now there could be another $300 million that may be necessary. Is there another number that's about to hit us? I mean, you know what I'm saying here? This thing is tracking upward, and if it's going to continue to track upward, then what it does is it leads to us to make sense next week to say, all right, fine, the Senate, you chose this 1.5 million number. Is that where this thing is taking us? And besides, if you don't use the extra money, they're carry over into 06, which affects your budget amendment that you bring to us. So help this committee out here understand this.
Mr. Chairman, that is a very valid concern. It's one that I share. I sat with the Secretary and testified to the $975 million at that hearing. And clearly, my belief is that $975 million is what we need to go forward with for the 2005 replenishment. But during that week, there was a good deal of activity in looking into what the actual consumption was by querying the field. And additional resource consumption came to light. We could have done a better job. We should have had more timely data. And I would concur with the what I take as, if not implicit, an explicit recommendation to improve the accountability, improve the timeliness, improve the clarity of the tracking of those funds. I know that in that process, we put the Secretary and we put you in this committee in a tough situation.
Well, please recognize, before I yield here, Mr. Evans, that when you make these separate requests, like the informing, separate request, Senate takes different action, we act on your request, there becomes a credibility gap. There's an erosion here. And then there is this corrosive rhetoric that's used out there that has a depreciating effect upon the men and women in uniform and the families, and none of it is healthy. Right now, I yield to Mr. Evans. I recognize.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, at this time, I want to give my colleagues a little bit of a head start here, so I'll yield at this time and yield to the gentleman from California.
Mr. Phil, you're now recognized for 5 minutes.
I thank the chairman. I thank the ranking member. Mr. Chairman, I appreciated the comments on accountability and some of the questions. I think we're more than a few months late and more than a few billion dollars short, however, because many of us were raising these exact same issues many, many months ago, and credibility was gone then, not just now. Dr. Perlin, I have watched this administration over the last month, the VA and the OMB, White House, basically show enormous disrespect for our veterans. I've seen an insult of the veterans, and I've seen it continue today, sir. You continue to talk about a mathematical model as if you're locked up in a little room with only a computer there, and you get figures from 3 years ago and you plug them in. Talk to people outside who are in the hospitals. Talk to the veterans. Talk to the VSOs who put together the independent budget. How come they were right on the mark? How come when I go to my VA hospital in La Jolla, I see almost 1,000 veterans on a waiting list? I see 300 vacancies in the hospital. I see nurses' stations unfilled. I see people waiting a year for a dental appointment, years for adjudication of their claims, not in your bailiwick. All you have to do is ask any veteran, and you know there's a problem. You keep talking about a model as if we are run by a mathematical model. It didn't account for a war going on. Well, correct the damn thing. Don't keep telling us that you're run by a model, which is what you keep doing. We know there's a war going on. Raise the number of people coming back. You know people are coming back with PTSD. Talk to them. Get the resources in there. You know there are vacancies. You're still talking about a mathematical model. I think that's incredibly insulting to the veterans of this nation. You talk about a commitment to veterans, and you're talking about some model and these technical things. We know what's going on there. This side of the aisle tried to, in fact, add the resources that you're asking for now, and we were kept being shot down by the other side because it didn't fit into their budget. And then you come to us today with another request, $1.97 billion for 06, when you know we have already refused to accept your policy recommendations on raising prescription drug fees and enrollment fees. You're acting as if, oh, we didn't know that happened. What about the $1.2 billion from that? Why don't you ask for that now? We already rejected the policy things, and you're coming back with some other number. So, Mr. Perdon, I don't understand why you're still talking about a model. You're still talking about figures which have no relevancy to the reality. When you've been found out, and you're still talking about as if you've not been found out. Let me ask you specifically. Mr. Bolton, head of the OMB, testified to the Budget Committee just last week, or maybe it was earlier this week. I'm losing track. He said each of the last 3 years, the VA healthcare system had $500 million more than it needed. This is what the administration testified, $500 million more than it needed in the face of waiting lists, in the face of vacancies, in the face of year-long waits. Do you agree with Mr. Bolton that you got a $500 million more than you needed in the last, that was appropriated more than you needed in the last 3 years?
Sir,
you're aware of that statement?
I'm aware of the statement, and I'm aware of the fact that, indeed, there were carryovers. I would like to answer your first question, though. In my statement today, sir, if I may, I did note that if Congress does not accept any of the policies in the President's budget, additional resources will be.
But we already turned them down. You're acting as if you don't know anything, just like you didn't know the war was going on. Just get out of your computer room. Look at the reality. Talk to the veterans who put together this independent budget. Talk to us who go to our veterans' hospitals and talk to veterans every single day that we're in our districts. We hear these stories, and you think we're just politicians who don't know what's going on. We know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. And you better start learning what's going on because you keep testifying as if we don't know what's going on. The chairman talked about a lack of credibility. You don't have any now, and you continue to talk in the same old model that you were that brought us to this thing. Do you know how many people are on waiting lists throughout the nation today waiting for their first appointment, and how many vacancies there are in staff positions throughout the nation? Do you have that figure?
Sir, there are approximately 25,000 today who are on waiting lists.
25,000? And you're still talking about a model? Why don't you talk to us how you're going to serve those 25,000?
That's why we came forward with a supplemental.
How many vacancies are there, staff vacancies around the country?
Sir, that's why we came forward with the request.
How many staff vacancies?
Appropriation.
How many staff vacancies?
What I can tell you is that we're approximately 7,000 FTAA above what was we had predicted, just so we could provide timely services to veterans.
That's not the question. I said, how many vacancies to serve the veterans that we have now? I mean, I'm told in my VA hospital in San Diego, there's 300 vacancies. Do we have a list of you should have a list of every hospital and what their vacancy is. Do you have that?
I could determine what number available throughout the system. The fact of the matter is we're approximately 7,000 personnel higher than were predicted.
So I'm not asking what you predicted. You just told us the model is ridiculous. I want to know how many we are fewer than to serve the veterans that we have and who are on the waiting list. How many short are we?
I'd have to come back.
Oh, come on, Dr. Perlin. This is what your job is. How many veterans we have to serve? Do we have the facilities and we have the personnel to serve them? You don't even have those figures. How are you going to come up with the right number if you don't even have these figures at your disposal? I tell you in my hospital what the figures are, and so that tells me how much money I need in the San Diego Medical Center. But you should know that for everyone. I mean, your statement was completely irrelevant to the needs, and your questions, you don't even have the information for the questions. Well, I would yield back whatever respect I have.
You have 127 vacancies in your hospital at San Diego.
Okay, so how many in the whole country?
Doctor,
I don't know. I do know San Diego because your office requested that information.
Yeah, but I know that figure. I want to know you should know what the figure is for the whole country. How are you going to serve the veterans if you don't know how many vacancies there are?
Thank the gentleman for yielding back his time. I appreciate you being responsive to Mr. Filner's question, and please get that in a timely manner to him.
For the record, he is not responsive.
I would appreciate, Dr. Perlin, if you would be responsive to the gentleman from California's request.
Yes, sir.
I would also think it would be very helpful in being responsive to his question when he made reference to the model. You had already testified previously that the model that Milman uses is also used in the private sector, and there was concerns about the data and the assumptions. So we're now getting into this and beginning to understand it a little bit better. You are also now having to deal with trying to get it right for 05. So we have to get this done before we leave for the August break. We've got an 06 budget amendment, and you're preparing the 07 budget as we sit here. So I think it would be very helpful to this committee, and being responsive to Mr. Filner's questioning, is what changes are you making with regard to input of new data or changes in the assumptions? Obviously, you took something into account by giving us an 06 budget amendment, and as you're working on the 07. I think that would be the best thing that would be responsive to Mr. Filner's concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to be very clear on how the model needs to be improved, because in fairness, this is how we identify what resource needs are for veterans and how we work together to identify a budget. As I stated, the formulation process to the budget execution has an inherent lag time. It's been arbitrary that end-of-year data from the preceding year have been used. For instance, the 2005 budget was predicated on end-of-year 2002. One of the things that we're working with the actuary to do is move those data so they're rolling, perhaps the most recent 18 months, so that it's a little bit closer to reality. We also know that veterans receive care in other environments, Medicaid, TRICARE, military treatment facilities. We also know that they have dental needs and long-term care, and all five of those categories, Medicaid, TRICARE, MTF direct care, dental care, long-term care, have previously been excluded from the model, and working with the actuary to include those. We're also looking to deconstruct how we failed in terms of getting it right this year. And we had discussion previously on better sensitivity to separating service members. They become veterans. So working with Department of Defense to get more timely information, not just about separation data in general, but about the activation and predicted separation rates of reserve members, old reserve component, who may be called up and then become eligible for care. We believe that those will be a number of features that will improve this model. You may say, I'm still skeptical. How can you rely on a set of methodologies given the experience that we've had? Truth of the matter is, we used to use a historical process. We used to just plus up on a historical base. Once we were off by 10% in 2002, unfortunately, we were short. In the previous year, we were off by 11%. That year, it was in VA's favor. Those degrees of variance or error are substantially more than the history of the model, even with its problems. So I would tell you that the model is not inherently bad. The challenge is in the lag time and in some of the additional data. And I understand Mr. Filner's concerns that the model doesn't operate in isolation. These are real people coming to real VA, and we have a real time obligation to get it right. That's why Secretary Nicholson was absolutely passionate.
But what's the difference if you get it right if OMB says you got too much money anyway? They're the ones that are making the final decisions. You didn't answer my question if you agreed with his assessment that you had a half billion dollars more than you needed.
All right. I need to ask for regular order. Thank you for the answer to the question. Mr. Miller, Subcommittee Chairman on Disability Assistance for Motor Failures, is now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I associate myself with most of the remarks of my colleague, Mr. Filner. Dr. Perlin, are you embarrassed? Are you embarrassed of what's happening?
I am embarrassed for what's happened.
I mean, here today we celebrate the 75th anniversary of the VA and all of the good that the administration has done. And you have members of this committee so angry about what's going on. And this is one of those committees where everybody tries as best they can to depoliticize what's going on, because our ultimate goal is serving the veterans. But politics will always creep into it. But the decisions and votes that I make are based on the information that you testify and you provide and the administration does. And I find it hard to believe that if you do these quarterly reviews that the information that you forecast through this model on is so stagnant that is causing the problem. I think something that a lot of us probably want to know, because it's affected every member on this committee and every member of this Congress, is when did VHA stop disenrolling beneficiaries that hadn't been to the VA within a 2-year period? Because we're all hearing that from our veterans, if you'll answer that first.
Yes, sir. I will need to check, because this has been a longstanding policy that if someone doesn't come for a period of 2 years, we open up the slot for the primary care provider to new veterans. So that I believe has been a policy. I will find out for you the date in which we began that. We require our primary care providers, on average, to have a panel of approximately 1,200 patients. And we want to make sure that we always open the capacity for the newest patients, and that was the rationale behind that decision.
You say it's a policy, so my next question is, under what authority do you have to make that decision? And when that decision was made, did you in fact inform Congress that you were going to be doing that? I'll tell you how we were informed. We got letters from veterans that came in and gave them to us. That's the notification that was made to us.
Sir, I should be very careful in the terms. It's not enrollment. It's impaneling with a particular care provider, primary care provider. But we do open the slot if the veteran does not come to that primary care provider after a period of 2 years.
And how was Congress notified that you were taking those steps? At what point did...
I don't know. I would have to find that out for you, sir.
And can you explain on page 3 of your testimony, second paragraph, where you said these amounts assume enactment of the policies in the president's budget, and if Congress does not accept any of the policies in the president's budget, additional resources to offset the cost of those will still be needed. Explain that a little further.
Sir, in the budget that the VA put forward, there were four policies, one requesting an enrollment fee, one for an increase of prescription copay. Both of those policies were priority 7 and 8 veterans, as well as two long-term care policies, one associated with state veterans homes and one associated with VA. The total monetary effect of those, or appropriation effect of those, was approximately $1 billion. And absent enactment of that, in addition to the $1.977 billion that we've come forward with the presidential budget amendment request for, an additional $1 billion would be necessary.
Surely you're not implying that this Congress is the reason for the shortfall?
No, sir.
Because this committee has said no to several of those recommendations, so I don't even understand why the inference is even in your testimony, because that has already been brought forward for authorization, and the answer was no.
Yes, we understand that.
Mr. Michaud, now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Perlin, I believe part of the reasons why you're spending so much time here with us is because the VA and the administration has failed to level with Congress and with our veterans. If you would tell us what you actually really need, then we could work in a bipartisan manner to try to address that. And it goes back to the same questions that we keep asking over and over again, and we don't get answers on, is what is the original dollar figure that you asked for? And we never seem to get the answer. And you've been around for a while. Secretary Nicholson, when he was here, he said he was only there for a few months. He did not know. But what was that number that you have asked OMB for?
You know, the challenge now is, of course, that our assumptions were off. And we've had very good dialogue with OMB on is exactly what are our needs based on our misestimation in 2005 and 2006.
But that's not my question. My question was, what was that number? I don't care whether assumptions were off or not. And it gets back to the very fundamental issue of whether or not you're requesting enough, but OMB is not providing enough. And it gets back to a question, actually, I haven't heard an answer that Mr. Filner had asked, dealing with Mr. Bolton's comments that you requested more money than what you actually need. And Mr. Filner's question was, do you agree with Mr. Bolton's assumption? Have you asked for more money than what you need? Yes or no?
In previous years, sir?
Do you agree with Mr. Bolton's statement that VA has asked for more money than they actually need?
I'm not sure that was his statement. I don't mean to be argumentative. I think he represented the fact that we carried over money in those years.
Yeah. I quote, there has been three consecutive years preceding this one in which there was more money requested by the administration and more money appropriated by Congress for the medical care portion of Veterans Services than was actually needed in that year. The appropriation have exceeded the VA's medical care needs in the preceding 3 years by over $500 million in each of the preceding years. And I guess my question is, do you agree with that? You've asked for more money than you need. And then the other question is, do you support the provisions that allow you this two-year authority for a portion of your funding, for your funding?
I would say that we requested what we thought we needed that in all years. And in terms of your second question, the two-year authority, I believe you're referring to the supplemental appropriation?
The authority as far as the two-year, using that carryover money, you're allowed 2 years to use it. Do you agree with that language? And if so, why?
Yes, sir. I think it gives us increased flexibility to spend responsibly. We want to make sure that, given the shortfall that we are experiencing, that we execute resources as quickly as possible, but never make decisions that are simply to execute funds before an arbitrary time period. We want to make sure that they go in the best interest of veterans.
Okay. My next question, and I mentioned it when Secretary Nicholson was here, when he first testified before the committee, and it was a question that I brought up because the Bangor Daily News in Maine had reported that Vision One had a budgetary shortfall for fiscal year 05, and this was in January and February when they actually mentioned that there was a shortfall. So they clearly knew back then that there was going to be a shortfall. My question is and it's as a result of my meeting last week with the VA, as I've learned that there's been incidents where Vision's actually been borrowing from one another for shortfalls. And Vision One, which is Maine, they've been forced to borrow money. My question is, how was this borrowing coordinated through the VA headquarters, and do you track it from year to year?
Congressman, it is not unprecedented to transfer funds from one network to another or to think that our allocation is absolutely perfect, I think would be overly ambitious. It's good, but it's not perfect, and we do periodically correct when we need to. And let me ask Ms. Miller to comment on how that's managed.
Thank you, sir. You're accurate in that Network One had the need for some funds for some non-recurring maintenance projects that were urgently needed and had utilized their non-recurring maintenance money for operations. Working through central office, they did coordinate to utilize funds from another network until the 06 budget, at which time they would return those funds.
And the second part of that question, if I might, Mr. Chairman, is do you track that from year to year, and what was that total dollar amount, and how are you ever going to make that up? If you're borrowing, are you going to make it up with additional funding in the upcoming budget cycle?
Sir, this is an unusual situation. I'm not aware of this occurring on an ongoing basis. This is the only one that I'm aware of in the recent past. We will track it. There is an expectation that those funds would be returned, and presumably that would come out of the 06 budget allocation.
You said you will track it, but have you been tracking it all along?
Since there haven't been any other situations that I'm aware of, we have not had the need to really track.
Okay. And what effect, if I might, Mr. Chairman, if the money's going to be paid back, say, from Vision One, what effect is that going to have on their, you know, that fiscal year's budget? If they got to pay back from a previous year, it must have some effect on the services they're going to be able to provide veterans, particularly since we have seen a shortfall in the care and in funding.
You're correct, Congressman, that there will be an impact on their 06 budget, but the issue was felt to be a timing issue in terms of moving forward with some projects that the network felt could not wait until fiscal year 06.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I want to start by thanking you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Evans, for the leadership that you're displaying on this issue, trying to get to the bottom of the problem, trying to rationally solve the problem. We all get in a lather once in a while in this committee, but I have to commend both of you gentlemen for really sticking up for the veterans and trying to resolve the problem. It would appear to me that just in looking at some of the big budget holes that have come up. Long-term care is something that, when you look out in the future, a three-year model ought to do a much better job of estimating the cost of long-term care. But that is something that a model can, I would think, adjust for. What the model evidently can adjust for, which makes sense, is the fact that we've had several hundred thousand people on the ground in that three-year period. And it would seem to me that that's why, if we're going to solve this problem, you need to look a little bit outside the box of your model. And Mr. Filner brought this up, that being the independent budget. And I, when Secretary Nicholson was here, asked him whether the VA was starting to discuss the parameters of the independent budget with the authors of that budget to try and resolve this, to bring a little bit more transparency and, unfortunately, a little bit more credibility to this issue. So I would really, this isn't a question, it's more of a statement, just urge you to think outside the box, to especially where there's an issue of now just moving targets of 975 and then 1.5 and now the 06 budget, and we're just left scratching our heads. The authors of the independent budget have seemingly done a much better job of anticipating what these costs are, and it would seem appropriate, especially given the moving target nature of this, to if our goal here is to solve the problem, and I think it is, and that's why I commended the chairman and the ranking member, and certainly the members on the other side of the aisle want to solve the problem. We want to solve the problem. There are some experts out there that I think you ought to be talking to and really talking to at great length and in great detail. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Hulick, may I make this statement? You know, Dr. Perlin, Congress also has to deal with the military health delivery system, and that model has been very challenging, and they've testified here also with you. But then Congress made a decision as we moved into the war that we would fund over and above from a supplemental. We have not done that as a policy decision with regard to the VA. And we said, well, the VA, this is in fact your job, is to receive. And it is rather mind-boggling, I think, to all of us here that surge of capacity of how DOD transfer these patients to you, many of whom, whether it's a soldier, sailor, or marine coming off of active duty to new veteran status, or in particular, the ones that are right down there in Bethesda that go to your VA for rehab and then you seek reimbursement. I mean, how all that wasn't taken into account in a model is mind-boggling to us. So we're appreciative that you're going to be very responsive to this in your new models. And thank you, Mr. Bradley, for bringing it up. Ms. Hulick, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, and Ranking Member, for having this hearing. And to Mr. Bradley, we do get in a lather, but it's because every single person in this room cares about what happens to our veterans. When I'm out speaking to groups and I'm talking about veterans' health care, let me tell you some of the things that I say. And I guess, and I'm not an expert in this area, but here's what I talk about when we talk about costs. And I said, we just haven't kept up with cost. And the reason we haven't kept up with costs is, I mean, first of all, health care costs are going up faster than the cost of living. Because of the war, there are more people coming into the system. As our veterans population ages more, it becomes more expensive. There's more long-term health care. We have a lot more. We have not lost as many lives in the war, but there have been a lot of wounded, and some of those are going to be extraordinarily expensive, and they're going to be severely damaged, and that's going to cost us more money. The cost of modern prosthesis has gone up. So I say those are all factors that we haven't taken into account when we look at the VA budget. And we need to increase that amount to give adequate care. And my question is, of just those things that a layperson talks about, those are the things that all of us know have happened. How much of those are in your model? And how much credence do you give all of that?
Thank you for that very insightful question. And the previous question from Mr. Bradley indicated that, and Chairman Boyer's comments, that there are returning troops, and a large number have come to VA. Fortunately, most have not had significant physical injury. Some have had particularly egregious trauma.
Right.
Given what we know now, and I think it's fair criticism to say that we should not look at life through a model, but through the lens of the patients that we're taking care of, we figure that in, and the numbers that I bring to you today that this administration put forward in terms of the supplemental and the President's budget amendment, we look specifically at the new prostheses to make sure that any returning service member who needs the state-of-the-art and equipment gets the state-of-the-art and equipment. Those things have not historically been figured into the model. In fact, they've been called non-model items. I can assure you that they will be scrutinized. And at the risk of being repetitive, I think that's why Secretary Nicholson is so passionate about meeting with this committee quarterly to be able to discuss with the chairman and ranking member the realities of what's going on in real time.
Do we take into account the fact that health care costs are going up faster than the cost of living?
Oh, absolutely. The actuarial model figures in any trends in healthcare inflation, figures in new technologies. It doesn't necessarily figure in those things that are unique to the service we provide, like prosthetics. And
the fact that we have an aging veterans population as well, and which is going to cost us more in long-term healthcare and just healthcare in general?
Yes, ma'am. The model looks at 55 different services being delivered, and to call it a model implies it's a black box of some kind. It's a computer, you push a button. It's not. It's a set of very rigorous methodologies And it looks at age of the patient and geography, technology.
Okay. And I have a little bit of problem with the model only because it didn't even recognize we were in a war. So that's what I have some problem. Let me just go on. And I just have to get this out because I'm very slow to get angry. There's not much that really, really makes me angry. And I am probably as angry as I ever get. And that is the waiting list. We're not talking about 7 and 8 priority veterans. I'm talking about waiting lists that are a year and a half, 2 years to get hip replacements or knee replacements or hip surgery. I happen to have had knee surgery, and anybody that I know that has had that kind of surgery, they wait until the last minute, until they really can't stand it any longer, and then they go in and have surgery. I can't imagine what it would be like if I needed hip replacement or knee surgery, and when I got to the point of needing that surgery, I then had to wait another year, a year and a half, or 2 years, and the pain that one person would go through. I think that is so egregious and outrageous. We shouldn't do that to people. I don't care who they are, but certainly not to our veterans. And my question is, when are we going to shorten those lists for those people waiting for that kind of surgery?
Right now. The enactment of that supplemental and the additional request for 2006, in each of the 2 years, a portion of those dollars are directly directed at reducing, eliminating those waiting lists.
Are they going to reduce the waiting list, or are they going to eliminate the waiting list? What do I tell my veterans that are waiting for those kinds of operations that are at the point that they can't stand the pain any longer? And it's not because the doctors and the nurses and the VA hospitals, they do a wonderful job, but they can only do with what they have.
They will receive that care with better timeliness than in any other health sector.
No waiting list? 6 months, 3 months, what are we talking about?
Our goal, let me be clearer in terms of our goal, and despite more veterans, and I would agree with you, there should be no veteran who has to wait, but despite these cases, the actual number of veterans seen within 30 days of the desired appointment date for both primary and specialty care is beyond 94% for specialty care and 95% for primary care. And that's the goal, is to have all veterans seen within 30 days and no veterans waiting over 90 days. And I've just been benchmarking that with other countries, other health plans, and if we could get to all of those veterans being seen in those time parameters, VA would be the number one in the world.
That's where I want it to be. Thank you.
Thank you for your support with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been a pretty active member of the committee since I've been here for the last 4 years and sat through many budget hearings, both here and privately and this and that. And again, you know, have really been supportive in giving the system, you know, what was asked for. My hospital has been affected in the same way as many have with the longer. Not the quality of service. The quality of service is excellent if you're fortunate enough to get in a reasonable length of time. And then also the lower priority folks, you know, using the, you hadn't been here in a while, you know, we'll be glad to see you in 18 months rhetoric. I guess my question is how do you, a couple things. First of all, I know that there's other hospitals that aren't in that situation. We're in the one of the fifth fastest growing region in the country right now, and yet with the growth have actually had positions pulled, which doesn't make a lot of sense. How do you determine that? I mean, is that a political decision? Is where the dollars are going? What is the rationale behind what hospitals are getting, you know, saying what hospitals are getting the dollars and what aren't? The other thing is that the second part of my question is that, again, you know, you've come to us again. You said, I need this amount of money, okay? And I'm very supportive of that. Mr. Filner and I had the opportunity to debate and visit when we were congratulating the 75th anniversary of the of the Veterans Administration. On the floor, I said, I'll support whatever it takes to get this thing right. So I guess my second part is really like Ms. Hooley. I mean, if we approve this amount of money for 06 and we got the 05, when am I going to see the quality of the service that we've had for many years in the Fayetteville VA? When are we going to see that, or are we going to see it go back to what I consider normal, that we've worked so hard for many years to get to that level? Now all of a sudden we're down below we're much below the standard that I see when I pour through the budget thing that you put out as far as your times and all that kind of stuff.
Well, Congressman, let me begin by thanking you for your support of VA and veterans, and thank you also for your acknowledgement of the quality of care. One of the pieces of context that I'd be remiss if I didn't provide as evidence in this past week's U.S. News and World Report, which referred to VA care as the top-notch health care delivery system. But there are waiting lists, and in Fayetteville, you've indicated it is the fifth fastest growing area of the country. And indeed, the numbers that I have over the past 5 years, the growth has been as high as 28.76% growth at Fayetteville alone, which is significantly higher than the numbers that we've been citing about the annualized growth of the entire system. You asked, is there a fair distribution mechanism to make sure resources get to hospital and the dollars should follow the patients? They haven't been following fast enough. And my goal with the resources that you are so generously supporting is to make sure that the waiting lists are worked down so that all veterans get care. And our VA performance, as I mentioned, 30 days for primary care, 30 days for specialty care, for 95% and 94% of all veterans respectively, and no veterans waiting over 90 days. And under no circumstances, a veteran with an emergency or in need of urgent services ever waiting. That is our goal, and that's what I intend to do with the resources.
So, again, with a growth of 28.6, which is way over, why would you actually reduce positions at that VA versus someplace else? How are those decisions made?
I think any decision to change personnel is made as a balance. I don't know the particular situations of what type of positions. Sometimes, you hire a doctor in lieu of someone who's doing maintenance. Sometimes you consolidate, and instead of a doctor, you might hire two nurse practitioners or physician's assistants. So I don't know the particular instances at Fayetteville, but I'd be pleased to right. look into.
But with the money that you're asking me to approve now to support you with, okay, we will go back to the level of service shortly that we experienced, or do you need to ask us for some more money? That's my question, is this enough, or do you need more? Because that's what I want.
Thank you for your support. Given this process, I think you all would fully understand that I have no desire to be back here in this chair asking for more. So I have scrutinized to the best of my ability the data that have come forward, looking at the needs for prosthetics, the needs of returning service members, and the needs of the veterans who don't fall into one of those unique categories but go to every VA and clinic throughout the country, said, do we have the right resources? And we have debated and discussed, and I am confident with funds in lieu of policy and with the supplemental and with the President's budget amendment that gets us to being able to provide not just the highest quality care, but timely and good service as you've requested and veterans deserve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. If I may, Mr. Strickland, what I've done is I've asked staff to pull recently received from the VA is the estimated waiting list as of July 15, 2005 for new enrollees and established patients that are over 30 days. So, Strickland, if I may, as a follow-up here off Ms. Hooley and Dr. Bozeman, as I look at this, and I just shared this with Mr. Filner, in Charleston, you've got estimated 1,638 patients. In Cleveland, 56. In Indianapolis, 287. Minneapolis, 807. Palo Alto, 3,789. Richmond, 1,093. San Diego, 621, of which 527 is dental. In Tampa, it's 2,650. So I'm sure we could take this out and put them across your entire spectrum. And I think the question that has been asked by two members of this committee is that you've asked for additional funds. Congress is prepared to give you those funds, of which you are then contracting out to take these lists down. So the question, I think, what the members are trying to get to is, are these the sources that you believe are necessary to take this waiting list down?
I, as I say, come forward with as much confidence as I can possibly have that these are the resources to take down not only the waiting list, but also veterans who are waiting beyond our service time frame of 30 days, the list you've just provided.
All right. There will be follow-up. You know you're going to be back here in the spring. So, Mr. Strickland, you're not recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Perlin and Laura Miller, someone I've known for a long time. Used to be in my great state of Ohio, and Mr. Norris, I feel for you. I really do, because I think you have a very heavy responsibility, and I think you're probably trying to do your best under really difficult circumstances. But you know, I'm looking at your testimony, and I want to go back to this statement. After you've laid out the financial needs, the budget numbers, you say these amounts assume enactment of the policies in the president's budget. If Congress does not accept any of these policies in the president's budget, additional resources to offset the cost of those will still be needed. That statement causes me to think that you're not dealing with this in good faith. How many times does this Congress, on a bipartisan basis, have to say no to those requests before you assume it is a settled matter and that it's insulting to us that you would bring us numbers based upon the possibility of that happening? It's not going to happen. The Republicans aren't going to let it happen. We Democrats aren't going to let it happen. Forget it. Bring us budget numbers that don't make those assumptions. Don't you think that's a fair thing for us to ask?
It is absolutely fair, given the clear voice of the entirety of this committee. The 1.977 does not include the president's policies that were in the budget. That is, as I mentioned earlier, an additional $1 billion. So just, I apologize for the semantics of that statement and even the tone of the expression, but you have asked for clarity in what the numbers are. 1.977 is additional, and from the congressional budgeting perspective, $1 billion is in lieu of those proposed policies for a total of $2.977 billion.
So you are asking for a sufficient amount of money without assuming that there may be these other sources of revenue, such as a user fee and the like. Is that what you're telling me?
If the policy proposals are not enacted, we need $1 billion additional.
They're not going to be enacted. Why would that continue to be a part of the budget request?
I think we are agreeing with the numbers. In lieu of their being enacted, the dollar figure is $1 billion, recognizing the sentiment of this, the Senate, and both appropriations committees. The amount of $1 billion plus $1.977 billion for a total of $2.977 billion.
So is that what you're asking for?
That is the figure that I believe will be necessary, sir.
But is that what you're asking for?
Yes, that is what I am here identifying the need for.
So we can assume that the next time we get a budget request, those requests for user fees and increased costs for medicines will not be in it?
I know that the sentiment of this committee has, for a number of years...
It's the sentiment of the Congress, this committee certainly, but the Congress. I mean, how many times... You see, Dr. Perlin, you're probably not responsible for this because, but how can we believe that you are bringing us numbers and you're doing that in good faith when you are doing this? I mean, that puzzles me.
I'm giving you an exact dollar figure in lieu of what the budgetary effect of those policies would be. I think I'm providing that very candidly, what the dollar value is
Do you support those proposals?
Those proposals?
In your position, do you support those proposals to have a user fee and increase co-payments for medicines?
This was part of the President's budget that the VA brought forward, and we testified to that effect.
And that's why I say I have sympathy for you, because I think you find yourselves in a position where you're having to take orders from someone. I don't know, maybe it is OMB, maybe it's the President himself. I doubt it. I doubt that a decision of this specificity would go all the way up to the President of the United States, but I want to tell you, someone's doing the President a disservice if we continue to get a budget from the President that has these requests that the Congress has thoroughly, totally rejected. And it just makes me wonder if we can believe or trust or accept in good faith anything that we get from the administration or from this department. And I'm just, I'm just saying that with, I feel kind of sad about it, quite frankly. And, Mr. Chairman, I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you. Senator Brown-Waite, you're not recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to request that an opening statement that I have be admitted into the record.
Shall be entered.
I appreciate
no
that.
No objection.
Thank you. When I saw that Secretary Nicholson wasn't here, I figured he probably was begging for his old job back at the Vatican. It probably was a lot easier than being the VA secretary. I have a few questions about veterans' health care in general, and I certainly agree that veterans' health care is top-notch. Do you all do any comparisons of, for example, number of surgeries that your docs perform versus out there in the other realm of medical care, i.e. the for-profit or not-for-profit entities? And the reason why I ask this is, Ms. Hooley, you might want to hear this. I had a veteran who had a very aggressive jaw cancer, and he was put on a very long waiting list for surgery. When I inquired, I was told that the oncologist does one surgery a week. One surgery a week. I said, I want that in writing, because if he does one surgery a week, I know about 8 oncologists who want his job. So could you all provide a comparison of caseload with the private sector? It's amazing, because when I did that, he suddenly got the surgery scheduled for 3 weeks later. The other question that I have is, does the VA treat non-veterans, not spouses, but non-veterans? And I will wait for your answer.
Your question on non-veterans is very complex. There are a couple of categories of people who fall into, not necessarily veterans. CHAMPVA, or CHAMPVA, is a program that is for beneficiaries of 100% service-connected veterans, alive or deceased, and that would include many non-veteran spouses, children in that program. VA will also provide humanitarian care. VA also provides care.
Would you define humanitarian care? Because this may be where we're going. Define humanitarian care.
Sure. Let me give you a personal example. I may be one of the few VA physicians to have delivered 2 babies to non-veterans. The women were there, and I was in the emergency room. They were ready to deliver. That was essentially a circumstance that was unavoidable. The care was provided. An individual who has a medical emergency in the parking lot or the hallway, we would provide care for.
And I appreciate that, and I'm sure the women who are about to deliver appreciate that. Where I'm going with this is I have several VA facilities in my area, and I'm not going to name the particular VA facility, but I was there on a tour, saw a wonderful demonstration of a piece of equipment, kind of a contraption that you get hooked up onto for walking purposes for anybody who had spinal cord injury. There was a very young girl there, and using this machine, and I said, was she a veteran? Because I guess when you get to be my age, everybody looks young. And they said, no, she wasn't a veteran. She was in a car accident. So my question is, are we using VA resources that should be used for veterans for the civilian population? I'm not making a judgment as to whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but I think we need to know where these VA dollars are going, because every one of us goes home and hears stories about veterans not being cared for.
Our first priority, our system, is there for veterans. I believe I could surmise what facility you're talking about, and I believe I know the program that happens to be a research program. And with research programs to improve the research that informs the care of veterans, when grants are obtained from NIH, for example, or from industry, they can be open to non-veterans as well as part of a research program. And I would imagine, because that is not a standard therapy, it's very state-of-the-art, evaluative research, that was the circumstances under which you saw that individual. I actually believe I was at the same place and saw two veterans who essentially regained their walking because of that research, and it's truly incredible.
It is an incredible program, but my question is, are veterans getting first dibs at it? Because Lord only knows we have enough veterans with spinal cord injuries as a result of this war.
Sure.
I want to make sure that we are using these dollars for people who have served our country. That's what your organization is all about. That's what we believe we're funding.
I would fully agree with you. And the circumstance, as I say, was likely one of a research grant, but the priority has to be always to veterans.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to make a request. You had said that you expected to see him back here in the spring. It looks as if we're not going to be out of here October the 1st, so we might want to get an update on exactly where the money is going and what they're doing and how the service levels are changing before the spring, so whatever time you deem appropriate. I think we really need to follow up and make sure that the veterans are being served and that they're being served in a timely manner with the additional appropriations that we are providing.
Gentlelady, if I may respond to this, we will continue our oversight here, and some things are going to be very telling for us. As we work through our 05, as we're into the October timeframe, we're going to know a lot of things. We're going to know about this 06 budget amendment. Is that even going to be enough? Dr. Perlin and his staff will be putting together an 07. And we're going to be working with VHA on a bipartisan basis to ensure that with regard to the data and the assumptions that they're done in a manner for which we also agree. And I think that just needs to be done. And so we can work cooperatively with you, and we can have these updated briefings, and we can bring you back here and brief the members with regard to the data, let us know what the changes are going to be. Put us in a comfort zone, because where you are right now with the committee is called earning back the trust, and I think that's probably pretty accurate. Ms. Berkley, you're not recognized. Would that satisfy the gentlelady's request? All right. Ms. Berkley, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, welcome again. I don't envy your position, and I don't hold you responsible for this. I don't think it's your credibility at stake here. I'd like to follow up on Mr. Strickland's line of questioning, because I think we need to get this on the record. I don't mean to put you on the hot seat, but we're going to be revisiting this again and I just don't relish that idea. On July 14th, Joshua Bolton, who's the director of OMB, sent a letter requesting additional monies for the VA to the president. And in that letter, he explained about the 2005 supplemental, and then he talked about the 2006 budget amendment. And when you add up the numbers of the $300 million expected carryover and the $677 million increase, which I think is lowballing it, but we'll go with that number, $400 million for the increase in the cost per patient, and another $600 million towards revision to request to correct for the estimated cost of long-term care, which I think is probably ballpark, we get to the 1.977, which is what Mr. Bolton recommends to the president to bring forward to the United States Congress. Now, your testimony today says, you talk about the total needed for both years, comprising the 2005 supplemental request of 975 and the 2006 budget amendment of 1.977. Then you go on to say, as Mr. Strickland pointed out, these amounts assume enactment of the policies in the president's budget. Now, I think we're all pretty uniform in our belief that this is already, in our knowledge, that this has already been voted down. It's not going to be brought forward. If it's brought forward, it's going to be voted down. So according to your oral testimony, we are going to need an additional billion in addition to the 1.977. So Mr. Bolton, the director of OMB, who should know better, has proposed to the president that he bring forward a number that is $1 billion short of what reality tells us we're going to need to satisfy the cost of providing service to our veterans. Is that correct? A yes or no?
No.
Not correct.
No. I think everyone in this room understands the likelihood of those provisions being enacted. I think that the director also appreciates that Congress, both houses, have really not only understood that they're not going to be enacted, but understood the need to replace the funds in lieu of those. So he fully anticipates that as the one piece and the 1.977 as the second piece.
But it does not, in the letter that accompanied, I'm assuming, the documentation to the White House, the Office of OMB recommended to the White House that they forward to the United States Congress. I carefully reviewed this proposal, and I'm satisfied that this is necessary at this time. I therefore join the Secretary of the VA in recommending that you transmit this amendment to Congress. But the reality is it's going to cost an extra $1 billion to care for our vets.
I believe that is assumed.
But not in this letter to the President.
No, this would be in and above.
So the actual number is $2.977 billion.
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Would my colleague yield just a second? I'm back here.
Oh.
this just gets to the idea of good faith and credibility. Why wasn't that billion a part of the request? I mean, I yield back to my friend. It's frustrating.
Ms. Berkley?
I'm anxious to hear Mr. Perlin's response, although I would say that this gentleman doesn't do policy. He does numbers, and the policy of the VA or the OMB is to the policy is to continue this myth that they're going to be able to generate revenue on the backs of the veterans, which the Congress has already made very clear isn't going to happen. I don't think this gentleman is in a position to answer that question because he crunches the numbers. He doesn't do the policy. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. But I do have another question. could you answer Mr. Strickland very quickly?
I'm sorry, your question is, I can't speak for OMB.
All right. That's
but
the answer.
If I could answer your first words, word that you don't envy my position. I would like this body to know that there is not a day that I don't realize what an incredible privilege it is. And I do hope that I represent that in terms of
you do. And I don't think it's pretty apparent you're not in this for the money. None of us are. I know you truly serve your country, and I appreciate that. This is what's concerning me. I got word while I'm here in Washington that OMB is all over my VA facilities, such as they are, limited as they are, in Las Vegas right now, asking the same questions they asked 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and last year. And before the CARE study was initiated, before it was completed, before it was brought to bed or sent to bed, and before we had a VA budget, that a VA appropriation that came out of this Congress that provided for the funding for a medical center that we are in desperate need of. Now, it worries me that with this shortfall, they're going to take money out of the capital budget. And that is, to me, if we start robbing Peter to pay Paul, the people that I represent, my veterans, are going to be in a world of hurt. And I left this committee, you may have noticed, for a few minutes. I had 200 Boy Scouts waiting to have a picture taken with me. I was out for 15 minutes, and believe me, this is not enough water to rehydrate. It is hot out there. While I'm walking back here, I am thinking of my 80-year-old veterans that are standing in, and we're having a heat wave in Vegas right now. This is the 21st day of over 118 degrees. I've got 80-year-old veterans that are standing in the heat waiting for a shuttle to take them from location to location to location to get their health care needs met. And my biggest concern, Dr. Perlin, is that we're going to start taking money out of the capital budget to cover the cost of the health care. Can you give me assurances that is not going to happen?
I believe strongly the need of the hospital in Las Vegas.
I know you do.
That in the 2006. It's a very poor way of doing business right now, shuttling between the multiple clinic sites, and I could not be more passionate about the support for that hospital. I would be remiss to speculate where I know or don't know, but the budget I've brought forward assumes resources for operations and preservation of capital. To the best of my knowledge.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I now yield to Mr. Evans.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Perlin, would you please break out your estimate of $1.7 billion request for us by breaking out?
Break out the $1.97 billion budget request for 06, is Mr. Evans's question. A detailed breakout, if you have it, please.
Thank you, Ranking Member Evans. Let me break that out, and I'll start at the highest level and then break it down to smaller groups. Let me start with $677 million. That refers to increase of the $1.977 billion. $677 million is in anticipation of increased workload. It's clear that the model did not predict the level of utilization of VA. And more veterans came in, and that is a piece of the workload. In actually proportionately smaller dollar figures, there are a group of returning service members. And again, it's been well discussed today that we needed to do better in terms of anticipating the returning service members from OAF and OEF in that $677 million of resources as well to care for returning veterans of OAF and OEF. Included in that $677 million, as has also been pointed out today, with respect to the waiting lists, we need to make sure that we work down those waiting lists, that we contract or hire or do what's necessary to get back on being within all the types of targets for timely care that veterans deserve and you have a right to expect. So that's the first part, the $677 million. The second group of funds relate to long-term care, and let me tell you that falls into two pieces. Part of it was that the 06 budget was constructed with an error built into it. At some point, it anticipated that the census would be lower in 2005 going into 2006, and that required additional resources. As well, there was a technical error. The total to provide the long-term care services necessary is $600 million. In addition, one of the things that has been apparent, both in the recent look at our budget and in looking forward, is that the veterans coming to VA, in addition to there being more veterans, they're using more services. They're using more services, perhaps because they're not getting those services in other environments. Perhaps they're using newer and more expensive pharmaceuticals. But the measures such as relative value units, things that measure procedures and time spent with patients, per patient is actually higher. And so $400 million of the 1.977 is for that increased utilization of services per veteran in 2006. That gets us up to $1,677,000,000. The $300 million is actually attributable to similar increases in utilization, but to replenish the carryover and make whole the 2006 budget, getting us to the total of $1.977 billion.
All right, Mr. Evans yields back.
Thank you.
Let's do the math here real quick. Based off Mr. Evans's question here, 1.677 plus the $300 million, if we go from, we approved 975, and then if you say you need another 300, if the House, if we actually over the next few days, say we were to take the Senate's number at 1.5, you've now got $200 million over and above a present mark for 05, so we replenish now, and we've got an 06 budget amendment. So when we hear Senator Hutchison in the Senate say, if the House will take our 1.5, then the 06 budget amendment comes down 300. That's where she gets that from, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, I got it. Thank you. Ms. Herthus, you're not recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I pose a couple of questions about long-term care, as I did in our last hearing, let me just, as you break that down for the $1.977 billion administration budget request, but then as my colleagues have spun out here, the additional billion, if the legislative changes aren't made on user fees and copays, which everyone I think has acknowledged isn't going to happen for fiscal year 2006 and likely beyond, separate from the concerns that have been raised procedurally about how this request came forward and how you're calculating it, where does the $1 billion go? I mean, where does the additional $1 billion that you've indicated will be needed if those legislative changes aren't made, where is the bulk of that $1 billion going?
Thank you, Congresswoman, for that question. I can't attribute that to a particular activity. It would restore the budget value of the cost reductions that those policies would have had, and so it would go to the general care of veterans, as would be represented in the overall formulation of the overall 2006 budget.
Okay. Now, is it my understanding is that by law, the VA is required to provide long-term care for service-connected disabled veterans who are 70% or greater service-connected disabled as space allows?
I believe that's correct.
And my understanding is that space is available, but staff is not. Is that true?
I would have to look at a particular site, but even for 70% or greater service-connected veterans, if we don't have staff, those veterans, I believe, are eligible for contracted community nursing home care as well. So we owe those veterans the care, whether or not we have staff, and
right.
If there's an issue, I'd be pleased to look into it.
Okay, but given some of what has already been stated in terms of the VA medical centers and what I would hope would be the quality of care in terms of the long-term care provided, I mean, the preference here would be to have adequate resources for adequate staff so that we didn't have to contract out to perhaps community long-term care facilities that may or may not be at the same quality standards.
Well, let me thank you and agree with you. I think our quality, in fact, I know our quality is exceptional in the nursing homes that we have. As a clinician who's practiced in two VAs, Washington and Richmond, frequently the decision is often made on the proximity to family, if that's a consideration. So as proud as I am of that, I know many veterans' families choose to have the veteran close by.
Now, when we talked about how we broke down the $975 million request for fiscal year 05 a few weeks ago, I asked a little bit about the long-term care, because that was like the second largest line item, I think, in how it was broken down. And at the time, you informed me that there was a partnership or research undertaken with the Department of Veterans Affairs and Duke University, I believe, and because there may have been either a technical error in the model or perhaps not a useful model to project long-term care needs. Has there been any new information you can provide us there? Because if we're going to be signing off on the assumptions in a model, it'd be nice to know the progress of that research so we're ready for the long-term care where we've seen an increase in health care costs as well.
Thank you, Congresswoman, for that question. You're absolutely right that previously VA did not use an actuarial model to project care. That was part of the problem. We now contract with Duke University, and that has been running in parallel with the Milliman. What we want to do is make sure that we integrate that in all of our projections. But it is a new tool to use, and I believe it will be more accurate.
So it's a new tool that wasn't used in the FY05 projections or for FY06, but will be for FY07?
I'll have to check and find to what degree it may have played a role in 06. I think there's been some experimental work to validate on small scale a particular state or network, but not the entire formulation of budget to this point.
But you do anticipate that?
Yes,
we'll be ready to do that as you generate a proposal in terms of VA needs for FY07?
I believe so, and I think I should get you the full details for the record so that I don't misstate, but my understanding is that it is now ready to be used at scale.
Okay. I would appreciate that. I think other members of the committee would as well, in light of the chairman's objective for where we may be as we get more information in the fall, that that's an integral part of the additional information that we should have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Thank you for your contribution. Dr. Snyder, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Perlin, what is your medical specialty?
I'm internal medicine. I also have a PhD in pharmacology.
In pharmacology. Thank you. Before you came, I'm just always curious about this. Incidentally, you said it was a privilege for you to have that job. I consider it a privilege that we have you working for the VA system, so I appreciate you doing this. When you prepare for this hearing today, do they still do that silly stuff where you have to have your written statement signed off on by OMB?
Yes, the statements, all testimony is cleared through the Office of Management and Budget.
Isn't that like the silliest damn thing you've ever heard of? You don't have to clear that statement with OMB. That was fun.
It is a complex process.
Yeah, it's being polite. And I apologize for being late, so it'll be probably kind of like the movie Groundhog Day for you that I'll ask you questions you've already dealt with. But I still am perplexed from our last hearing, and you and I have not sat down and talked about this, on this whole actuarial model and why it has to run 2.5 and 3.5 years behind. I don't know anything in business that runs 2.5 and 3.5 years behind. I mean, have you all had discussions in these last 2 or 3 months where you've said, you know, let's target, you know, 6 months from now, we're going to have a model that will have an 8.37-month turnaround time? I mean, you couldn't make a living in business with a 3.5-year modeling time. What direction are we going with that?
I think that's a very good point, that, and we have had discussions about more frequent runs of the model to make sure that we're tracking closer to reality.
Is that something that's contracted out? Is that a formula and all that business? Is that a proprietary formula and process?
The ultimate, yes, there are parts that are proprietary, and it is contracted out to Milliman. The actuary has extensive background. She supports and her organization, support managed care organizations, and health plans, as well as some other public programs, including Medicaid, and I believe they also do some work for Department of Defense.
I mean, so it is possible just to say, hey, the good news, bad news, the bad news is we ain't going to do this anymore. The good news is you've got a chance to bid on a contract to have an 8.5-month model. I mean, isn't that right? I mean, you can just throw that out there and see what people come up with.
Yes, we could do this more. We could do it cyclically, and we do it cyclically for each successive budget as well.
Yeah. What reporting requirements do you have to make to Congress, not just budgetary, but reporting requirements do you have to make to Congress regarding access of care and quality of care?
I consider it our responsibility to Congress, reporting on anything that is asked of us. And in fact, we've not formalized the particular document, but I believe that when the Secretary intends to meet with his committee quarterly, that he would put down a selection of markers. Let me share with you, if I may, what I look at. I look at 6 measuring baskets. I look at the quality of care. I look at things that are very patient-centric, access to care, satisfaction with the services, measures of restoration of function. I look at a measure called community health, which is a basket for those other areas, our effectiveness in research, and our academic mission, and then cost effectiveness. And I would submit that those would be the things that we should be sharing with you as well.
When you all sat down and looked at those things in your whatever your most recent time framework was to look at those prior to we had all this budget shenanigans, did not anything stick out for you there that told you, you know, maybe our 2.5-year actuarial model didn't reflect things that jumped out? Did you notice that, I'll make something up, our patient satisfaction rate went down because of waiting times? Our doctor satisfaction rate went down because they say, you know, I'm seeing the same number of patients, but they're more complex now, and I'm having to work 2 hours overtime. Or our waiting times for specialty clinics, or waiting times for new patient appointments. Is that not done in such a way that something would leap out to give you, like, the canary in the mine? Something is happening out there. Our models may be off.
Yes, the area that is leaping out most prominently, as we've been discussing and people have indicated, are waiting lists, and that indicator is showing that we have the need for these additional resources.
May I ask you, well, with the chairman's indulgence, but my question is, I'm sorry I missed those discussions earlier, but the last time that you looked at that, did not you all have a discussion that said waiting times are way up compared to where they were a year ago, or our model must be wrong? Did you all have that discussion, or did you just, were the world so divorced, the budget analysis and the model was so separate from your quality and access control evaluations that you didn't put those two together, or somebody didn't put those together?
Now, we actually review the tracking to plan at the monthly performance review, and that was really the indicator that triggered these discussions to begin with. But the question is how in the future can we avoid getting to this point, and even better, making sure that there is a better match of resource and need, and that is our task now. Thank you.
Mr. Evans and I were up here talking based off Ms. Hertha's question, so if you could help us here. You've got your budget that you submitted to us that included the enrollment fees, increase in copays. Congress right now lacks any political will, it appears, to do anything on these. You submit to us an 06 budget amendment for the 1.97. So that amendment is added onto your budget. So overall, we're still before Congress is the enrollment fees and increased copays. Congress selects not to act on those. What you've said to Ms. Herthis is that your need then is approximately $3 billion, right, if we back those out. So when the House passed its appropriation, $1 billion over and above your mark, the House basically bought bought that out.
Yes.
Right? Not doing the fees and the copays.
Exactly.
So when you come to us and ask for the $1.97 billion, what you really need from that's what you need now from Congress, over and above the House's mark, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. I just want to make sure we're right on that. Mr. Filmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad you're here, Mr. Dr. Perlin. You have done something. You have brought this whole committee together. I mean, when the Republicans are associating themselves with my remarks, you've done a remarkable job. So I thank you for that. I'm still, and I'm not in the camp that has said you're not responsible. I mean, you're the deputy for health. You are responsible for what goes here. So you're accountable, not. You're not just doing something that somebody tells you to do, I don't think. But we're still living in an unreal world here. I mean, your testimony continues. I think all this stuff about the model is irrelevant, frankly. That's what technicians do, and then you have to live in the real world, and that's your job. You can have someone doing a model, and then you have people say, oh, we got a war going on. Did you take that into account? Or, you know, we have hepatitis C now. We didn't know about that last year. So that's your job, and you didn't do it. And we all knew there was a problem before you found it. I mean, we all knew there were freezes on hiring, either verbally or in memos. I mean, we get this stuff. People in your administration send them to us. There were freezes on enrollment. There were freezes on maintenances.
What?
Right. So everybody knew it, so I don't know how you can even continue to say we just found out about it. We all knew about it. The question is, you know, again, how we're going to deal with it. Several people asked you, I'm going to ask you again directly, because I don't think when I say the model is irrelevant, not only is it irrelevant because you have to test against the real world, but the OMB seems to have a far greater impact no matter what your model says. You asked for a figure for FY06 from OMB. What was that figure relative to what OMB recommended to the Congress? I mean, that would be a more fair test of your model.
Well, as I said before, there's a good bit of additional knowledge now in terms of where we are.
Look, either answer the question or say you don't want to, but don't give us this bureaucratic nonsense. I want to know what figure you sent up to OMB. Now, Mr. Principi answered that question. He said they gave us $1.2 billion less than we asked for. Mr. Nicholson said, oh, I don't know. I wasn't there. Well, you were there, so what figure did you ask?
Well, obviously, this committee has discussed the challenge, the box of what is embargoed nature of information, and my desire to answer your question directly.
So you can't answer it directly. All right. It puts you know, you're probably better than you're appearing because you probably asked for a higher figure. So you're taking all the blame for something that is not maybe not your fault, but. I guess what, as a layperson and as someone who's just looking at the system, I would say to you that rather when we ask what are your measures, you give us these six baskets. I mean, okay, professionally that's what you got to do. But in the real world, why don't you every month or every quarter, I don't care, go on to the measures that we use. How many people are on the waiting list for how long? And what are you going to do about it? How many staff vacancies exist for how long, and what are you going to do about it? What's the maintenance backlog, and how are they going to be fixed, and in what time frame? I mean, these are what we do in our own house, what we do in our own budget, what we, you know, if my son needs a dental work, I'm saying I don't care what the model shows my salary is. I got to figure out when he's going to get his dental work is. Or we have an emergency. How I got to put the money here. What does that do to the rest? And how are we going to make it up? I mean, we all do that every single day in our household accounts, in our anybody who has a business. And, you know, we're just still boggled by the fact that you can't do this simple thing. So give us that stuff. And give us a timeline for doing it. Nobody questions anybody's motivation here or your concern for veterans. Everybody in your agency does that, and we all do that. But you're forced to give us bureaucratic nonsense that is not in accord with the real world, and you become an uncredible spokesman, and the administration becomes an uncredible help because you're talking in a green eye shade world out there, but somebody's putting this model out and you have no info, human intellect has no role here. So I would like to see the next time you come, some of those measures, not these big baskets you're talking about, but tell us, why do we have to come up and tell you how many people are on the waiting list? You should tell us.
Sir,
and what you're going to do about it.
Sir, those are our data. And I.
But when I asked you, you didn't know it. I asked you earlier, how many people are on a waiting, or how many vacancies exist in our hospitals, and how many people on the waiting list? You didn't know. You didn't tell me.
Well, I didn't memorize the exact number of vacancies, but I do know the exact number.
Well, I would tell you, if there were vacancies in my agency, I could tell you the exact number. I could tell you, because that is my job to eliminate those vacancies. It's my job to eliminate the waiting list. It's my job to eliminate the maintenance backlog. That's your job. And our job is to support you in that, and you're not giving us any way that we could support you because you're not giving us any data. I yield back.
Thank you. Mr. Michaud?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I, too, want to thank both you, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Evans, for having this hearing. And, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member, I agree with both of you that getting the VA budget right is very important to me, and I'll work with you both to make sure that we do that. I just want to follow up, Dr. Perlin and Ms. Miller, on a question earlier about Vision's borrowing money to make ends meet and the response that they would have to pay that back. It's my understanding that in Vision 1, they actually did borrow $11 million. And my concern is with the capital needs and the increased amount of veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, if they had to borrow before, and they have to pay that money back without additional funding, my concern is what's going to happen to Vision One. And I like to have you looked at the specifics on why they borrowed the money, and if they have to pay it back, are they going to be able to meet the needs for veterans in Vision One? The other part of that question is under the CARES process. Because of the access issue, there was it recommended either four or five clinics, since Maine's such a rural state, in Maine, plus a CBOC. When you look at the borrowing that they have to do, the shortfalls, whether or not that's going to ever come to fruition.
I think the issue of the borrowing money was really a timing issue more than anything else, because the specific projects, which I've seen a list of, which did total about $11 million, were felt to be needed sooner than could be managed by waiting for the 06 budget. Certainly with the supplemental and with the discussions that are going on now about the 06 amendment, I think that changes the scenario for the network and more than likely would minimize the need for that loan.
Okay. My next question is to Dr. Perlin. As the VA keeps referring to the highest priority veterans and the core group veterans, do these definitions apply to the veterans that are on priority 7 list?
Congressman, there is a policy or directive that went out, I believe, about a couple of years ago that emphasized a priority in terms of the access to care for veterans who are 50% or greater service connected. And by definition, that would not include the priority 7s or priority 8s in the system. Mm-hmm. All veterans are meant to be served within our performance goals, which are 94% within 30 days for primary, 93% within 30 days for specialty care. And our actual performance is even higher, though, as your colleagues have alluded to, I do know and do track, because those are our data, our waiting lists, where that's not the case.
In response to the funding shortfall, in January of 2003, there was suspended enrollment in Priority 8 veterans. Does the fiscal year 2006 budget request fail to provide any additional funding at all for Priority 8 veterans? And if so, is that going to be the policy from here on out of the VA and the administration? Is it just to leave Priority 8 veterans out there?
Yeah, the budget request would serve those Priority 8 veterans who are currently in the system. The budget request does not anticipate reopening enrollment to Priority 8 veterans.
Okay. Is that going to be the policy that we will never, as long as the administration's in office, open for Priority 8?
Yeah,
new enrollment?
I'd be remiss to speculate on that.
Okay, but no additional funding is anticipated for any new enrollments then in Priority 8?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Schneider?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Perlin, in your exchange with Congressman Filner, the discussion about the waiting list. Did you say you had some numbers in mind with regard to waiting lists? I assume that was one of the things when you and I were talking about it, that one of the six things you follow is waiting lists. And,
absolutely.
And do you have numbers in mind?
Yes, sir. There are approximately 25,000 veterans waiting for appointments to be scheduled at this moment. And
both primary care and specialty?
For their first new primary care visit.
For their first new primary care visit.
The numbers that Congressman Filner quoted were actually those veterans who were waiting beyond our target of serving those veterans within 30 days. And I track those for the entire system, for the network, for the facility, and even a community-based outpatient clinic. And it is something that I am very acutely aware of, because one of the reasons we track this is not because it's a bureaucratic or abstract number. It's real service to real veterans.
But that should be the kind of thing, as you and I were talking earlier, that as you follow along month to month, year to year, as you start seeing a negative trend going in the wrong direction, should say to you, maybe our modeling is not working, our actuarial model.
Yep. Yes, sir. That is the sort of thing that tells us either things are working or they aren't. And in fact, between that point in January of 2003, when that enrollment decision was made, and there were 176,000 veterans without appointments scheduled and 317,000 veterans waiting over 6 months for care. And that was worked down to a low of about 5,000. I actually think there will, and this is not a question of performance, it's a question of the lag between the time a veteran enrolls and when he gets his first appointment. I think that the minimum is going to be somewhere around 5,000, and that's just that period of time between enrollment and their first visit, so that we are beyond that perfect steady state of getting veterans care as soon as they enroll.
When you have looked at reasons, and that you listed some, I think, in your written statement, and about why the model didn't work, have you all thought some beyond the kind of the world of the veterans healthcare system as to why it might not be tracking as well as you may have thought it did in the past? For example, it occurs to me that we have seen an erosion the last few years of employer-based healthcare. And there may be veterans who no longer had employer-based health care, and so they had to start coming to the VA. Or they may have been in an employer-based health care system or got priced out of the market because of pre-existing conditions, had to come to the VA, and then you make reference to a more complicated patient, or that certain retirees, their retiree health care system, companies are dropping that. Have you all looked at why you think you may be having more complicated patients and patients requiring more visits? Are those some of the things that have occurred to you all?
Dr. Snyder, that is something that in fact, I did allude to in my statement. And one of the things we need to improve are the conditions that we're in tracking health insurance coverage and coverage for particular services and pharmaceutical coverage. I know that the pharmaceutical coverage in particular is something that's quite excellent about VA's care, and need to look at the effect of what's going on in the broader environment even more carefully and even more carefully regionally, because it's not necessarily consistent across the country, in terms of how that might attract veterans into VA. Yes, sir.
I think one of the problems we have as a country is we have not figured out how to do health care, no matter what system you're in, whether you're working for a private business or you're a retiree or you're on Medicaid or responsible for Medicaid or Medicare or military health care or TRICARE. So when one part of the system is struggling, which I think the private sector is, then the government programs have to step in and make up the slack. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Mr. Evans for his indulgence, because I have a series of questions to ask. Mr. Norris, what do you believe are the critical elements of the monthly performance review briefing?
Thank you for the question, sir. I believe that obviously tracking the expenditures against the planned expenditures and understanding the reasons for the variances for that is important, as well as comparing it to the previous year to see how we're tracking in relation to what we expected to do overall. I think also looking at the workload that we want to track against our plan and against the previous year's experience as well. Those, to me, are the two most important things. However, there are other areas, too, that one might want to look at.
Well, let's drill it down again to another step. How current is the data at the time of the monthly review?
The financial data are the previous month's end-of-month data.
So when you say February, that data is what?
When we do a performance review in March, we would be looking at February data.
30 days old, approximately.
Well, probably less than 30 days old at that point, because we would do it sometime during the month of March. 2 to 3 weeks old. The workload data is somewhat more troublesome in terms of timeliness, because we have to draw that from several databases. One, we have to wait for patient records to close in the field and those databases to be closed out. We have to match that against data out of the enrollment files to match that up with the priority group levels to ascertain where the growth and the changes are occurring. And then we also have to associate it with cost and look at assigning cost to each of those group levels so that we understand better where the costs are being incurred and where the workload is being incurred. Those data matchings cause us to lag beyond the level of time that we would like to. More recently, we have been trying to estimate a month ahead of time or a month in advance of what we actually have solid data on and test that against later on when we get solid data to see if those estimates are in fact good enough for decision making.
When you look at these numbers on a monthly basis, do you also then look at these numbers from the previous year?
Yes, sir.
All right. And when you look at it from a previous year, then you're able to chart a percentage up or percentage down?
Correct.
All right. If you were to actually have graphed If I were to ask you to graph it over the last year, can you tell us what that graph would look like?
We saw, I believe, we started off fairly normally, and I believe we began to show, we sort of begin to show slow growth through the early part of the year, and then we saw a fairly significant growth around January time frame, and in the January-February data, which we were looking at in the April-May time frame, and that's when we discovered that, the problem was more significant than we had earlier thought it to be.
So if I were to ask you, would you be able to tell me what that surge capacity, strike the capacity, if you were to tell us to were you to tell me what the surge is in February, March that caused you to send to recommend this letter be sent to Congress on the reprogramming of funds? I guess what I'm trying to figure out is the surge 5%, is it 6%, over and above 05 to 04? And if it's 5 or 6%, but it's based on 02 data, it's really much greater. So I'm trying to drill right into the numbers to figure out that if not only is it the model, but maybe it's our monthly review. I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah, I understand. I think we had projected using the data from '02, and the model had projected a workload growth that would be about 2.3% over what we experienced in '04. In the mid-year review time frame, when we did this in the April-May time frame, we saw that the growth was about 5.2% at that point, which was higher than we had predicted.
And would that be – did you break out categories then, just as Mr. Michaud and Dr. Schneider had asked, regarding categories 1 through 6 versus 7s and 8s?
Yes, sir. And the
can you tell us what that where that surge was coming from?
Or most of the growth was in the priority 1 through 6. We're actually seeing some leveling out. There's still growth, a bit of growth in the priority 7s and 8s, but quite naturally because we're not bringing in more priority 8 enrollees, that number is fixed, the population from which those would be using. So really the growth has been in the priority 1 through 6s primarily.
And out of the 1 through 6s, were you able to break out what is OIF and OEF?
We had projected in our budget calculations about 23,000 veterans or OIF, OEF veterans to use us and use our services in 05. We're now thinking we're going to see probably around 100,000 this year.
Wow. All right. So this goes back to your testimony, Dr. Perlin, of almost 3 weeks ago with regard to this surge, for which was not anticipated when the when this budget was put together, correct? Am I trying to do the right follow-up
yes,
here? Who at VHA is responsible for tracking and trending the spend rate?
I do that, sir.
How do you plan to keep track of the budget trends in the future so there is not a repeat of this?
Well, I think we will continue to do all the things that we are now doing in terms of looking at the monthly spend rates against the plan. And obviously, we need to refine our plans somewhat in terms of the phasing of those expenditures throughout the year to ensure that what we project, where we project we will be at a particular month, is a little bit tighter fit than we've had in the past.
Of the original request, 975, how much of the 975 million can actually be obligated before September 30th?
Sir, that's an excellent question. It obviously depends on a lot of things. Primarily it depends on
let's put it this way. Let's give you this what if.
Okay.
That the by next Friday, this issue is resolved, and you get your number, whether it's 975 to 1.5 billion. You're going to get a number. The president signs it. Bang. What can actually be obligated?
We think we can obligate the majority of the 975. However, it is dependent on some of the repair projects. For example, require a competitive bid process and contracts, et cetera. And to the extent that we are now almost to the point of only having 2 months left in the fiscal year, to the extent that process drags on, they may or may not be able to be awarded and that money actually obligated. Now, in financial parlay, we could commit that money. It's still an unobligated at the end of the year, committed to those particular projects, and would be obligated then early in FY06. But we think we can obligate a fairly large portion of the 975.
When DOD reimburses the VA, at what rate does that calculate off of?
Well, it depends on what the particular service is. We have an agreement with DOD on outpatient rates that we will exchange services based on CMAC, that's the chaplain's maximum allowable charge rate, less 10%, which works for us quite well and keeping things simple and encouraging sharing between the two departments. The inpatient rates are a little bit more problematic in that DOD doesn't have a good inpatient billing rate system yet, which they are working on that, and we're working with them. And then there are rates negotiated locally between facilities based on services available in either department's facility and the cost that they incur at those local facilities so that they can at least recover their cost.
When you testified about this increase in OIF-OEF workload, how will you forecast or predict this future workload?
Well, I think one of the things that, as Dr. Perlin has stated, we need to get improved data from DOD, which we're working on doing and getting more current data. I think that's forthcoming, and we will certainly use our most recent experience in looking at also hopefully some discharge rates and those sorts of things that would enable us to get better projections of the impact of OEF, OIF, or any other deployments around the world.
Based off this, Dr. Perlin, how timely is DOD's data on separating OIF, OEF personnel provided to the VA?
It's gotten better. It's every couple of months. It's not a defined schedule. We get a computer file that shows separation. And I think there are two approaches that I plan to take. One is to try to get that data even more timely. The other is to be very conservative this year and extrapolate from the experience and anticipate the same or accelerated levels of service member return.
Does DOD provide the post-deployment assessments as an assessment tool for the VA?
That is a complex question. Nominally, those data are available. However, they're not electronic, and they're not something that the service member might bring with them. So the answer is if you ask, is it available, the answer technically is yes. Is it available in a very practical and simple way? The answer would be no.
Ms. Miller, how often do you conference or teleconference with all your VISN directors?
I have a weekly phone conference with them and a monthly meeting, and that is with all of them as a group. But in addition to that, on a quarterly basis, there are individual hour-long briefings with each network director.
Are there minutes from these meetings?
No, sir. There are minutes for the monthly National Leadership Board, which includes all of the chief officers as well as the network directors. There are agendas for the weekly teleconferences, but there are no minutes.
How candid are your VISN directors with you?
I would say they're generally pretty candid.
What's been the trend in VHA's backlogs in ambulatory and specialty care appointments for the past 12 months?
Well, actually, the trend on the totals is a good trend. It is that we are seeing an increased proportion of the total appointments, the 95% in primary care and the 94% in specialty care within the 30-day timeline, and an improvement in those that are above 30 days to bring them down below the 90 days, where we have seen a decremental performance is in those who are waiting for their first appointment.
Would you please provide to the committee graphics to support the answer that you just given me?
Yes, sir, I will.
Ms. Miller, have there been any documented cases where returning OIF or OEF service members have been denied care?
Sir, not that I'm aware of. We have repeatedly reinforced to the field the importance of providing those services in a timely and compassionate and seamless manner.
Do you know any documented cases where returning OIF, OEF service members have been given an appointment that is more than 30 days?
Yes, sir. I do believe there are cases of that type, and I know specifically in the dental arena that we have a backlog of cases, and that we are working on those with $20 million that's been provided to the field to address that specific issue.
See, what's happened here is individuals of whom are very upset, in particular your critics, what they do is they latch on to the new veteran to say that you don't care about them or you're not funding them. I know you've heard all the rhetoric that's out there. So I'd like for you, Ms. Miller, at your next meeting with all these visiting directors, I want you to go back and ask them this question on whether or not they know of any cases of OIF, OEF service members that have been denied any form of care.
Yes, sir.
And I also would like to know immediate action taken in the field to ensure that any of these soldiers, sailor, airmen, marine that are returning are beyond 30 days.
Yes, sir.
At what point were you informed of funding concerns from facilities and vision directors that they were having to take actions in the field?
Sir, I think when we got into the first of the calendar year, people began to identify that it was going to be a very tight and difficult year, and they began to hold on equipment and NRM purchases until they saw where the year was going. And as we moved along, it became clear that they were going to have to use the NRM and equipment money for operational purposes. At the same time, they were focusing on advanced clinic access to try and work down the waiting list and improve productivity. And we were monitoring closely with them compliance on national contracts and pharmaceutical procurements, et cetera, to try and assure that they were being the most efficient that they could be.
And you're saying that's the January time frame?
In January and February, early in the year, people began to say, you know, we're seeing this increase in, as Mr. Norris said, in the workload, and they began to hold back on moving ahead with their equipment and NRM
right.
money.
I'm not so certain how that reconciles with Mr. Norris's testimony with regard to the monthly review assessments, that he the things were tracking fine until we began to see the spike in March, February, March, April. If you're hearing from the field that they got crunch problems in January and it's not being reflected in this monthly assessment, see what I'm trying to say? Do you two talk?
Yes, sir, we do.
Sir, I let me clarify. I meant to say, if I didn't say it clearly, that there was slight workload increase in the early parts of the year, in the early months, but they weren't alarming at that point. However, as we hit the mid-year point and looking at the January-February data, it was getting to the, quote, alarming
state. Right. I don't know how to define alarming. So let me go to you, Ms. Miller. When was it brought to your attention that facilities were beginning to curtail services?
Sir, I don't believe that facilities were curtailing services in that period of time. I think they were acknowledging that things were tight. They were looking carefully at their budget and managing tightly, that they were refraining from moving forward with planned equipment or NRM, as I mentioned, and that they acknowledged at that point in time that they were not prepared to move forward with some CBOCs, but I'm not aware that they were curtailing services per se.
When did facilities start to send out letters of disenrollment?
I would like to make a distinction between enrollment and appointment. We do not disenroll any veteran. when a facility...
If a veteran had not used the facility over the last 2 years, were letters sent out saying that you would be disenrolled from the system?
Not that I'm aware of, sir.
So what letters were sent out with regard to appointments?
When a facility is unable to provide a service in a timely way within our guidelines, our policy requires them to notify a veteran that they are on a waiting list. And generally, we find that it is not an appropriate thing to provide appointments more than 4 months out, because oftentimes that appointment will not be at a convenient time, the veteran will not show for the appointment, it will be a wasted time slot. And so there is a policy that says that when we cannot provide you with an appointment in a timely way, that we want you to utilize the electronic wait list at the local site and take people off of that wait list as expeditiously as possible. But to notify people then in urgent or emergent situations, we would see them immediately.
If I wanted an appointment and I couldn't get my appointment for 4 months, am I being denied a service?
You're certainly being delayed in the service, and it's not good customer service, and it's something that we're trying to overcome, sir.
All right. So you've testified that you were not informed of facilities that took any actions that may have curtailed services. Is that correct? Is that correct?
I'm not aware of people, for instance, closing.
Right. And you've testified that your visiting directors are candid with you in these teleconferences.
Yes, sir.
Of which you don't take minutes. You take notes?
No, sir.
That's clever. When was it brought to your attention that critical maintenance was being deferred? When did your vision directors talk about deferring maintenance, facilities, equipment?
As I testified earlier, early in the calendar year, it became clear that people were going to need to defer equipment and maintenance procurements for operational purposes.
When did you then speak to Dr. Perlin about what you're hearing from your vision directors?
I try to keep Dr. Perlin informed on an ongoing basis.
That is not responsive. When did you, when you heard, or you've testified to January, when you started first hearing this from the field, did you go to Dr. Perlin and tell him what you're hearing from the field?
My memory of exactly when is not clear. I would
Boy,
say
notes and minutes would help, wouldn't they?
Yes, sir, they would.
Yeah.
Early in the year, I would say that I shared that information with Dr. Perlin.
Early in the year. Well, I'm not the prosecutor. I don't mean to be interrogating you like one. I assure you that I prosecuted the greatest wordsmith I ever met in my life, named Bill Clinton. I've had it. Do you have any follow-up questions? Sure.
Dr. Perlin, just a quick question. Are you in violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act in FY 2005?
No, we are not.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Sorry. But I wasn't going to lie.
Wait a minute. Dr. Perlin, if I could for just a second. I will ask this of you. I'd like for you to conduct an internal review to see if any personnel changes need to be made within the department and report that to the secretary. I would also ask for the GAO to conduct a thorough and comprehensive review of the VA's budget process. I will ask my colleagues on this committee to continue to monitor closely this budget process as you build the 07 budget to ensure that the mistakes that were made in 05 and 06 were not repeated. Finally, I intend in the August break, I will take a personal travel and I will go to some of the polytrauma, I'll go to a specific polytrauma center to see whether or not this allegation that some are making that OIF and OEF are being denied their access to care. And those are the actions I'm going to take based off today. Hearing's concluded.